So.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Feed Your Head, and I want to start out with a shout-out to all my vegan family for making the world a kinder place. And tonight, in our second hour, we have Tim King from Salem News. And in our first hour, we've got Lisa Alkins-Goodman from LisaLinks.com. So, just from the title, Lisa, I think you spill a lot of things. Am I right?
I try to stay on top of it, Bruce. Yeah.
Okay. It's good to have you here. Thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is such a big thing, and I had not even heard any kind of anything about this, and
nobody has it. It's never been released. Dan Carter had spent millions of dollars of his publisher Simon & Schuster's money on investigating Seymour Trammell's accounts of what had actually taken place during the Nixon administration and his assassination attempts, which were numerous, and we know about some of them. We know about Jack Anderson, you know, because Nixon
right.
was so paranoid yeah. about him. But no one knows about this because it was hush-up money, kept it on the down low. And, yeah, there's maybe, besides Simon & Schuster and Dr. Dan Carter, nobody knows about it. And, I mean, this no. is why Nixon stepped down as president, and the Watergate scandal was brilliantly crafted by the Nixon administration, you know, because it was a lot easier for him to step down as president than it would have been to go to prison for attempting to assassinate a state governor,
exactly.
presidential candidate. Yeah.
Right. Now, this is called the Alabama Project, but the book that you are writing about it is Madness in the Magnolias. And
yes.
I love that title. I love it because anything to do with magnolias or jasmine or Spanish moss, I start getting all excited because, you know, I'm from the North and I love the South. And so
yeah.
I love the title. Now, it was known to the people involved. And we should say that we were talking about Governor George Wallace and the assassination attempt on his life, more than the one that we all know about. There was more included here. But the how do you start out with this? How did you start out, Lisa? What did you first find?
I'm so glad you asked that because it was a fluke. I had seen a comment, a post on an alternative broadcast online newspaper, and it was from Warren Trammell, Seymour's son, and it said, "I have absolute proof that George W. Bush and Bush Sr. were involved in the assassination attempt of my father, Seymour Trammell." And I thought, what?
Really?
And I just, I had responded to the post and didn't find anything. And so I typed in the guy, Warren Trammell, that had made that post. I just typed in his name. I Googled his name. And the only thing that came up was his Facebook account.
Okay.
And so I contacted him, and I said, I'm real curious about that statement. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? And so he did, and so I was completely on board as soon as I heard the story. And I asked him, you know, would you be willing to send me your father's manuscript? You know, would you entrust me with it? And he agreed. Huh? And he sent me the original transcript, and it's 320 pages. It was, he had typed it, Seymour Trammell had typed it out in prison, and he and his son snuck out a few pages at a time under the guard's nose, you know, because he was really afraid that if the guards had found anything, you know, because Nixon had their eyes on him,
right?
You know, that, you know, who knows what have happened. They were in fear for their life. And so that's the story of how I came to meet Warren. And after I read the manuscript and then the additions that Seymour had wanted to add to it but couldn't do in prison, because it really, it implicates a lot of very high-profile people, not just George Bush Jr. and Sr., but other members of Nixon's plumbers, remember the plumbers?
Right. And Attorney General John Mitchell.
Yes.
And now Seymour and George Wallace, governor of Alabama, they were involved with five different presidents. I guess we should say first that Seymour started in 1962 running George's campaign.
He started running George's campaign in 1962, but he was running John Patterson's campaign before that, which incidentally ended up in an assassination before he even got together with Wallace. But Wallace begged him to, you know, to come over on his side, and the rest is history, as they say. He was a... Seymour Trammell was a very wealthy man, and he put a lot of, you know, his own money to back Wallace, you know, who came very close to beating Nixon. I mean, that race was really a close race.
Yeah.
He could have thrown it. He might not have won it, but he could have thrown that race.
Yeah. So that was... I find it fascinating that you say that it was really this that sparked the step down and all. But we were told it was Watergate, yada, yada. Because, like you said, it would be better for him to step down and to serve time as for attempted assassination.
Absolutely, and that's why Nixon was so paranoid.
Well... I know I've read things about, I guess, you know, I thought that there's no more bubbles left to break, but there are. You always find one that they're there and somebody's going to pop it, because people, you know, for years and years, since way back then, they've been using somebody's religion either against or for them.
Right.
And I'd read that Nixon was a Quaker, and they are very peaceful people. However, I would say, sort of like this last time, Romney was not a good example of Mormons. I think Nixon was not a good example for Quakers or of Quakers.
Not at all, yeah.
But you yourself are working with a former CIA agent. Am I right? Robert Baer?
Robert Baer.
Mm-hmm. And historian, Dr. Brinkley. So how did you hook up with them, Lisa?
Well... we wanted to have someone, you know, credible. We didn't want to attract any of the, you know, the conspiracy people,
right.
Even though this is a legitimate conspiracy, but
right.
As in any political conspiracy assassination, some things are very difficult to prove, but we've got strong circumstantial evidence. so I just started when Warren turned over his dad's documents to me, I started going after into historians, first of all, because Dr. Dan Carter is a historian, and he's the one that wrote The Politics of Rage, and he wanted to base his entire book, The Politics of Rage, on Seymour's manuscript.
Wow.
But Simon and Schuster, it was devastating, not only to Seymour, but also to Dr. Dan Carter, because, you know, Simon and Schuster, you know, at the time, they said there's too much incriminating evidence here, because they spent the money to prove it, because Dr. Dan Carter is, you know, he's legit, and so he spent a lot of money making sure, you know, that what Seymour had presented to him was the truth. And it was. They were able to prove that. And then Simon and Schuster wouldn't allow him to include it in his book, which is why it took him 3 years longer to finish the book, because he basically had to rewrite it. And there's a lot of missing pieces to that. And so I'm trying to garner reputable, you know, people that, you know, like Dr. Brinkley just finished writing his book on Cronkite, and he's still on tour with that. His research team is poring over Seymour Trammell's documents right now at this moment. And both the Nixon Library and the JFK Library also are reviewing it to include in their archives. This is a real historical document. This isn't, you know, that's why I didn't want to go after, you know, Alex Jones or Jesse Ventura. No disrespect to them. You know, I mean, they do a lot of work, but, you know, we want to present this in a way that represents historical facts, because these are historical documents.
Yeah, sure. Well, that makes sense. How long has it been since you first received the manuscript, or since you first saw the post by Warren?
It will be a year in February.
Okay. So you have been hard at work.
This is all I do. I mean, I have another job as well, but all I do is research, and boy, the more you dig, the more you find.
The more you find.
And, yeah.
Wow. Well, you told me that, or I read, actually, Lisa's written a wonderful piece on her site. It's called The Alabama Project, and it's from October 18th of this year. So you can find out all kinds of things there. And so we were talking about the presidents, JFK and Lyndon Johnson, and both Bushes were involved. Do you want
to? I just got done listening to about an hour long audio tape from the JFK Library Robert Kennedy is having a discussion with Seymour, with Wallace, with Edward E. Reed. About this is just prior to the school incident, you know, where Wallace stepped forward and said no segregation.
Yeah,
they were trying to hammer out a way to approach this, how to deal with it without bringing law enforcement in. And that's what this, I'm going to add that tape to my Alabama Project. Incidentally, the reason it's called the Alabama Project is because that was the code name that the Nixon administration had used for the assassination attempts to take Governor George Wallace down.
Okay.
Jack Anderson.
Sure. And I mean, it makes sense, but it was the code name. But
yes, it was a code name.
So if someone were to, because I didn't do this, I should have. If someone were to Google Alabama Project, they probably wouldn't get much.
The only thing you'll get now is from Lisa Leaks, because
Okay.
No, yeah, Mark. Now, Mark Feldstein had written about the Alabama Project briefly in his book. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he wrote a book called "Poisoning the Press: The Rise of the Washington Scandal Culture." He is the only person I've spoken to him. He's actually reviewing Seymour's manuscript right now as well.
Okay, so it's getting a lot of reads.
It really is. Sent it out to quite a few people. Max Hogan from New York Magazine. I've tried in vain to get it out to Woodward and Bernstein, but they're really hard to track down personally. I've spoken to I've corresponded with their assistants, who have said, yes, I'm gonna pass this on to them. But, I mean, that's been going on for about a year now, and I haven't heard anything back.
Yeah. Well, now, after you got the manuscript and read it, and like you said, you jumped right on because you really believed him. And all this, how does hopefully Warren Trammell will give us a call during this hour, but I wonder, how does he feel now that it looks like something's really happening? Because all those years he had this manuscript, but he didn't try to do anything with it?
Oh, yes, he did. Both he and his dad tried for years and have spoken to numerous different people. And, I mean, the bottom line is this. There's a lot of incriminating evidence against people that are still alive today.
Right.
And everyone has been too afraid to touch it. They just won't touch it. The same reason why Simon and Schuster shot Dr. Dan Carter down and wouldn't allow him to include it in his book, because there's some very high-profile people that will be, exposed that are still alive.
Yeah.
And that worries us. That worries us, too.
Sure. Yeah. Because these people are, let's just get real, they're ruthless.
They're killers. They're trained assassins,
Right, right. They've done it before. And
mm-hmm.
would you want to explain how George W. fits in? Because this goes way back. Remember, this is 1972, and he was in his 20s. What?
He was 26 years old,
What role did he play, Lisa?
Okay. I'm not sure. I had never heard of this guy before I started doing this research, but Winton Red Blunt was the postmaster general to Nixon, and he had him run against John Sparkman, who was very popular at the time. And George W. Bush, during those years that George W. Bush allegedly, I'll say that in quotes, went AWOL between 1968 and 1972 with, Dan Rather was fired from CBS for reporting on it.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a pretty big deal. He was fired for reporting on it. W. went to work for Red Blunt's campaign as a guise to be an undercover spy on the Wallace campaign, because Nixon wanted all eyes on Wallace to see what was going on. And at the time, W was getting into a load of trouble.
This was a way
to kind of shuffle him off and kind of integrate him into the CIA affairs, Poppy Bush. And so that's what he would do. Bush Jr. would hang out at the numerous political gatherings and campaigns of Wallace and report back on his findings.
Wow. Okay, what a job. I mean, and, water holes and everything, I suppose, then.
So that was
It was a real party time. It was a party time for W. I mean,
He
already got in trouble for drinking and drugging too much, and so they kind of gave him, let's get him out of here, let's move him over there, and give him a job to do, and I'm sure he enjoyed himself during the process.
Sure.
He dated a lot of pretty women, and there's numerous accounts of those women who I've tried to contact, and they won't come forward either.
Wow. Oh, wouldn't that be fun? I mean, just to hear about. So that's what he was doing when he was AWOL. He wasn't really AWOL, okay? Well, now
he was AWOL as far as the, you know, as far as being in the National Guard, he wasn't supposed to just go missing.
No.
I mean, the guy didn't fly the planes, you know, but he was terrified. He was terrified.
Yeah,
but, you know, he got the nice suit. He was a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
All of his records, you know, have vanished. I've already searched all that out. There's, so many different, they got water damaged or nobody knows exactly what happened to his files.
The tornado took
them. Tornado took them.
Okay.
God,
well, then how did JFK and Lyndon Johnson fit in this?
Well, because Seymour had been, you know, so active in John Patterson and then Governor Wallace's campaign that he interacted with them on a pretty regular basis. Now, Robert Kennedy didn't like Seymour because he just didn't like him. He said one time, that Trammell, you know, I'm worried about him. He's going to get somebody killed.
Mm.
And Seymour would always address him as Bobby. He didn't like that.
Oh.
So that was respectful. And that's something that it's pretty evident in this hour-long audio tape from the JFK library that I listened to. He was clearly annoyed by him. He had a lot of power. Seymour did. He had a lot of power. He had a lot of money and a lot of influence. Now, most people, as did I, always referred, you know, to Wallace, you know, because of the segregation.
Right.
Actually, that was all just BS. He wasn't. That was just a tactic to gain support. He wasn't
at
all. Yeah. He was an independent at heart.
Wow.
Seymour was just real smart. He was just a real smart guy with a lot of money. And that's what made Governor Wallace so famous was the whole segregation issue.
Exactly.
Which is something that he really felt, he never felt that way at all.
Well, then was that Seymour's idea?
Oh, yeah.
That was his idea. Wow.
Yeah.
That
he was the campaign director.
That seems like a very rough thing for somebody who doesn't believe in it to, like, stand for.
He wanted to win.
Yeah, yeah, obviously. Wow.
And that was the way to do it. And then Seymour also represented Governor Wallace's wife, but she was the first lady governor ever, Loralee. In the state of Alabama, and she, unfortunately, at the time, she was suffering. She had cancer, and George just pushed her, even though she was very ill. But Seymour took over her campaign, won that for her, cost her life, unfortunately. And from what I understand, she was a very lovely person. I spent over an hour on the phone with Gene and Bill Jones. Bill Jones was Governor Wallace's press secretary, and Gene and Loralee were very, very good friends, and she just spoke so highly of her and just adored her, just, you know, a real Southern beautiful
lady.
Woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, well, that, so, I mean, even though then we find out that George Wallace himself was not that big a segregationist, still he mouthed the words, he stood there, and then you think, okay, that's bad enough, but then he actually pushed his wife so far. I mean, so he wasn't necessarily the greatest man in the world.
No, and he had a lot of women on the side. He just didn't, you know, he just didn't appreciate, you know, really or care, you know, yeah. that much for yeah. her, especially her being, you know, as ill as she was.
Right.
And Seymour, it's very evident after reading Seymour's manuscript that he had a real love and appreciation for her. And was really disheartened, you know, by the way that George treated her.
Yeah. Well, now, but explain to us why Seymour was in jail, which is where he typed out this 300-some-page manuscript.
Well, since Nixon had failed to assassinate him, I mean, they brought him back to life. I mean, the guy had massive
accident,
chest injury, head injury, lost his eye. You know, he got a glass eye afterwards. I mean, it's just really, it's a miracle that he survived it at all.
Set up car accident, right?
Yeah, they had drugged him. When he was at the diplomat, socializing, that's when Nixon's team, the plumbers, had made their hit on him. Okay. Very similar to the Jack Anderson, you know, the MK Ultra, the LSD and all of that. They had drugged him, and he wasn't even that far after leaving the diplomat, the place where they gathered, that he had his near-fatal accident, but that he survived. And since he survived, plan B was to go after, to then 7 months later, they paid for and trained Arthur Bremer and planted his note, you know, those notebooks in his apartment and all of that stuff.
Mm.
So they went after Wallace and they tried to kill Wallace, which is very suspicious in itself because the news agencies were quickly instructed to go cover this campaign of George Wallace where Arthur Bremer was there. And if you watch the videotapes, which most of us have, they keep that camera on Arthur Bremer before he shoots Wallace. If it was even him that shot Wallace, because there was another member of the plumbers that was there right at his side, and I'm reluctant to say that person's name because he is still around and he's a very dangerous man.
Mm, okay.
But since so two failed assassination attempts, the next thing in line was to incriminate Seymour, who was, like I said, a millionaire, a very wealthy man, incriminate him on these bogus charges. That he failed to file taxes on a swimming pool.
Oh my God!
And the jury thought, oh, well, all he's going to have to do is pay the $3,000 fine, and then that's going to be the end of it. No, he was sentenced for 4 years in prison.
Okay, so that
was the maximum federal prison camp at the time.
Right. I believe we have, is this Warren on the line?
Yeah, this is going to be Warren.
Warren,
yes,
too.
Ma'am.
Okay. So he's been listening to a little bit of this. We've just got your father, we've just got him in jail right now. But Lisa was telling us that you smuggled out his papers.
That is correct. At that time, it was illegal for an inmate to write anything about his case. Today, it is legal, but back then, it was illegal. And so he would type 15 to 20 pages every few days, and I would walk in. They would let me in. I was the only person allowed to come visit him. And I would walk in with a Montgomery Advertiser, and we would sit across the table from each other, and he would slide the 15 or 20 pages into the newspaper, and after the visit, I would walk out with the newspaper, and I sneaked it out 15 to 20 pages at the time.
Wow.
For a total of about 305 pages.
Okay, so now you could have gotten in trouble. I mean, he would have gotten in more trouble, and you could have gotten in trouble.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
But this was something that you both wanted to get out there. I should say that this is Warren Trammell, who is Seymour's son. He's on the line, and we appreciate him calling in. I know you've talked with Lisa a lot.
And every day.
that's good, because that you know that you're going to get this done and out there. How do you feel about that after all this time, Warren? You've wanted to get it out and about, but just that post that you made under a year ago, Lisa saw it and hunted you down. What did you think when she came after you?
I was very surprised and, not quite sure at first, because I was on the East Coast and she was on the West Coast, and I didn't really know what kind of interest, you know, she might have.
Right.
So I was very curious as to what, because somebody in the state of California to contact me on this.
Well, I think it has less to do with the fact she's in California, much more to do with the fact that Lisa likes to ferret out the truth.
Well, it took me a few days to figure that out.
And then it's like, okay, here we go.
And I just want to say that I love this man. He is great.
Have you two ever managed to meet live and in person yet?
Not yet.
Ah. That's
working on
fine. Well, is there an estimated time of publication on the book, Lisa?
No, there's not. I mean, I said, we're just those historians, and the interested parties that we have are mulling it over. Our greatest hope right now is if the Nixon and the JFK Library want to include it in their archives, that they're going to run with this, you know, because they're probably going to want to be the first ones to get their hand on this manuscript, you know. So, like I said before, we want to kind of avoid the conspiracy theorists, although nothing against them at all. We just want to have a high-profile individual or group to represent this, because these, like I said, these are historic documents written by a key player of, you know, Governor George Wallace, who has been able to, you know, clearly document the fact that Nixon stepped down as president to avoid going to prison for the assassination attempts of a state governor, a presidential candidate, and his number one campaign advisor. This is a game changer to Watergate. I want to give a shout out to all of those people that there's not a day that goes by, I swear, that you don't hear about Bush or Nixon. This is a story that's never going to die. But the truth has yet to be told.
Yeah. I don't know how old you were, Warren, when this happened. And so I don't know, before it, had you been pretty much, like some of us were before we became disillusioned, pretty much pro-government and thinking that the government was a good thing and it wouldn't, those in power wouldn't do anything to hurt us. Had you had those ideas ever?
No.
No,
you
never did. Okay.
He grew up in politics.
Right. So he had no illusions then. Yeah.
None whatsoever.
Wow. So none of this came as a surprise. And so all of these things that we've been going through in the last few decades, it's
not surprised you a bit.
No, not in the least.
So has it always been this way? I mean, way before, you think, since the time our country was founded?
No.
I do.
Either of you.
Go ahead, Warren.
Well, yes, I think so. I think there's always been political maneuvering since the founding of the country. And just the fact that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated tells you that there were, you know, bad, mean, cruel people in the world at that time and who would do anything to change the course of history. And since the assassination of Abraham Lincoln to this very day, politicians have been assassinated and other forms, you know, to achieve a political goal.
Right. And sometimes it's been by their own quote unquote people to establish a martyr or something.
Absolutely.
And that just makes me sick. I mean, I was a kid when I got that figured out, and I could not get it. You know, why? But sure, because they're thinking ahead. So somebody's going to die. That's just horrid, though. But, you know, in the article that Lisa has written on Lisa Links in the Alabama Project, you mentioned that when Governor Wallace was shot, the shots came from a couple different places, apparently.
Well, I haven't been able to, you know, 100% nail that down. But the fact that Bremer's gun, okay, Arthur Bremer did not have gloves on. There were no fingerprints on the gun. And supposedly none of the bullets could be recognizable, that they were somehow destroyed. And so they couldn't link that gun with those bullets. It's very suspicious to me. I mean, it should be to any even casual observer of the fact that there's no fingerprints. He wasn't wearing gloves.
Right.
And none of the bullets were, they weren't able to match any of the bullets up to the gun that he used. I mean, it's been, you know, widely reported discrepancies that had emerged during that time of the investigation that included that, you know, his fingerprints and nor his palm prints were not found on that gun, although he is shown on the film without gloves, the bullets that entered Wallace's Wallace showed trajectory from above and behind, okay? Although Bremer supposedly fired all of those five shots from directly in front of Wallace. So the entire scene was captured on CBS News, who purportedly, on the trip from the CIA, on a tip from the CIA, they told CBS News to be there that day, quote unquote. CIA told CBS News to be there that day. The bullets that struck at least three other witnesses, two of them, of the bullets were removed and recovered, but all the bullets were so damaged that not one of them could be linked to Bremer's gun. Hello.
Does this sound like Lee Harvey Oswald and the Grassy Knoll or something?
Exactly. You know, and there's been a lot of people that have come out now that one, I don't remember the gal's name, but that one woman that just recently, you know, said, I mean, we've all heard there was a second shooter. We all of us know that.
Yeah.
But the fact that they weren't able to recover any evidence from Bremer's gun, and that the trajectory, you know, from above and behind. Now, Warren and I have slowed down those tapes of that shooting and have, you know, really looked as well as we can with the naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
There's one shot, there's one piece that I noticed that it looked like something quickly, but if, I mean, you only would see this slowed down frame by frame by frame.
Okay.
There at the shopping center, that it looked like that there was something coming through that Wallace from the air from above. And now, and we've looked at, I've taken a lot of pictures, screenshots of the Laurel Shopping Center, and there's plenty of places where there could have been a sniper, you know, that was shooting. But like I said, I already told Ruthann that I'm not comfortable with seeing who else was at Arthur Bremer's side, so not to mention any names. But,
right.
You know, there was a member of Nixon's plumber team that was right next to Bremer at the time of the assassination attempt. What we just talked about it tonight, it could have been that he replaced the gun, and that's why there weren't any, you know, handprints or fingerprints, which is impossible. It's impossible.
Right.
You can't not have fingerprints, or palm prints.
There's just no way. And, you know, you can be checked for the not powder burns, but just powder on your hands, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So
yep.
That doesn't make a lot of sense. Do you think that, because sometimes we hear that some of these agencies do things that, well, just, you know, maybe some of the black ops now are doing things that President Obama isn't aware of. And
sure. So, like Benghazi.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know. I'm not a fan of Obama's. I think he could do better. But I do know he's got a hard job. But do you personally, the two of you, are you sure in your heart that Nixon actually knew what was going on?
Absolutely, we know what was going on, because what the Alabama Project was. The plan was to assassinate Wallace, to assassinate Seymour first, and then to assassinate Wallace.
Well, I understand that. I'm just saying that Nixon was in on the planning. It wasn't just his that were planning. But
absolutely. You bet.
Yeah. Wow. When your father got out of jail, Warren, what did he do? How did he spend the rest of his life?
They took his law license away from him, and so he tried to do some legal work for some of his lawyer friends, which he did do. And then we spent the rest of the time actually looking for publishing companies and publishing agents to try to, publish this manuscript.
Okay.
And and Lisa might not know this, I maybe haven't told her, we actually went through probably three or four or five literary agents and three or four publishing companies.
Yeah.
All over the place.
And nobody wanted to touch it, huh?
That's right, because Nixon was still alive and there were some other people still alive.
Yeah.
And it was so controversial, it just scared people to death and they wouldn't talk to us.
Yeah.
And then, of course, one day we were contacted by Dr. Dan Carter out of Georgia, who was commissioned to write a book that was supposed to be the definitive story about this. And he was commissioned by the largest publisher in the world, Simon & Schuster. And he finally came out with his book called The Politics of Rage. But he to show you how unknowledgeable people were, Dr. Carter was actually deemed the most expert person in the world on Southern history. And when he talked to my book, And when he talked to my father and got the story and got the manuscript, it caused his book to be delayed over 3 years coming out, because even Dan Carter didn't know the story. And it took him three and a half years approximately to research everything and to really prove Seymour's manuscript to be accurate. And that's really why we went with Dr. Carter, because he was a PhD and was the sitting chair of Southern History at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and was commissioned by Simon & Schuster to write this book. But Dr. Carter encouraged us to get our story out, because Simon & Schuster would not allow Dr. Carter to print the whole and to write the whole truth.
And Ruth Ann, that's in his book. Dr. Dan Carter even noted that in the back of his book. He noted that Seymour Trammell had never misguided him or told him anything that wasn't true. It's in the back of his book.
Okay, impressive. Yeah. So he wanted to at least get that out if he couldn't put everything else in the book. Yeah.
Yes, but he won't speak to us now. We don't know. We can only speculate, you know, as to why. You know, he either, you know, signed a contract that he'd never speak of it again. You know, we don't know. We don't know that for a fact. But that's
right.
I have certainly tried to contact Dr. Carter on numerous occasions, but he gives Seymour the highest respect in his book and notes that he hopes that he will, he writes here that he will speak, you know, let me just grab this one and flip it on this is Dan Carter. I never found an instance in which he misled me, talking about Seymour Trammell. He has his own fascinating story, and I hope he will eventually have the chance to tell it.
Okay. So, here it comes. Here it comes. Now, like you say, several of the people who were involved in this are still alive. And they have the funds, they have power. What do you think is going to happen? Are you going to find a publisher, or are you going to have to do some type of self-publishing, you two?
Well, we'd prefer to not self-publish.
Right.
Why we're trying to go after a credible, high-profile, you know, well-established historian or, you know, author who is, you know, credible and legit. Now, if no one's going to wake up and smell the roses on this story, then we will self-publish, you know, because we have to.
Well, you have got to get it out. I mean, one way or another.
We have to get it out.
So, But no, I know what you're saying as far as it gives more credibility if it's picked up by a publishing house.
Absolutely.
So I hope that there's somebody out there who's brave enough. I know so many of the smaller publishing houses have closed. They've been bought up or, you know, bullied up by the bigger ones and things. So
yeah,
I really wish you luck on that. And it can happen. You know, things are changing. So it's very possible. What has this led you to? I mean, besides the politics are crooked, what has it led you to think about just now, politically, what may be going on, or what has gone on since then till now that maybe we should look at a little differently? Have you run into anything, or has this just taught you that everything that's put out there is not necessarily true?
Oh, well, I was raised to examine everything, question everything. My grandfather was a CIA. He worked during World War II as a spy for the United States, but he was German, And I was very close to my grandfather. And ever since I was little bitty, you know, he said, don't ever believe what you read in print and examine everything. And that stuck with me my whole life, which I believe is kind of like divine intervention that Warren and I have met each other because, you know, this is something I have committed to, that I have sunk my teeth into this because there are people that, you know, well, the general public deserves to know what the truth is about Watergate. And right. I also believe the connection to what's happening now is more evident than it's ever been. It's like you can't fool us anymore. We get it, you know. It's just a, you know, Obama's a puppet. And he was brilliantly crafted by the CIA, incidentally. That's a whole nother story. I can go on about that forever. I'll let Warren answer his perspective on that.
So, Warren, what would you tell people then when they see things going on? And do you think that there's something major that we've missed between Wallace's attempted assassination and now that is totally different from what we've been told?
Yes, absolutely. I would say probably 90% we don't know what's going on. We only know 10% or less of really what is going on. The politicians are masters, and their handlers are masters at covering up the real activity of what is going on. And Benghazi is a perfect example.
Yeah.
In fact, of that, and you can look back now through history of all the shenanigans going on, there's always a cover-up. The timing, actually, if you look at the dates, of the date that Wallace was shot in Maryland, which was May the 15th of 72, the burglars were caught in the Watergate Hotel also in May, about 4 or 5 days later. So there was only maybe a week or so difference between the date that Wallace was shot and the Watergate burglars were caught.
Wow. So that was really planned down to, well, the day, apparently.
Sure.
Nixon brilliantly crafted the Watergate scandal so he could step down as president so he wasn't implicated in the assassination attempts of a state governor, presidential, you know.
Well, now, what do you think made him think that he might be implicated?
Because too many people knew about it.
Okay.
Too many people knew.
Okay, so the assassination team was large enough and wordy enough.
Well, and John Mitchell contacted Seymour when John Mitchell, who was a very close friend of Nixon, this is show you the character of Nixon, his very close friend and confidant, you know, he arranged for him to go to prison, and Mitchell was so paranoid that Seymour was going to, you know, that had, you know, figured out, you know, that he was probably one of the guys that was in on the hit on the assassination attempt of his life, that Mitchell would call him for prison, and we're trying to get those tapes. We've been trying to get that. I don't think they recorded. It doesn't seem like they've recorded those tapes back then. But Nixon was so paranoid. Who knows? They might be laying around somewhere. But Mitchell confessed to Seymour that he was not the one involved. And that's when he spilled the beans on George Bush Jr., his implication, and who was involved on the assassination attempt of his life. It was John Mitchell. John Mitchell is the one.
Wow. So, he had been, I mean, not that he was any prize, but Nixon did treat him shabbily. I mean, for somebody who was supposed to be such a friend.
Yeah, he most certainly did.
Yeah. So, do you want to talk just a little bit about your site? Because there's so much on there, Lisa. We've just got a few minutes. LisaLeaks.com.
I just try to, things that are passionate to me, you know, I mean, my number one passion is to get Seymour Trammell's manuscript out because they are historic documents. That's my number one passion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Palestine, the conflict between Israel and Palestine, that's right up there. And just revealing the facts, not from my perspective, but just the facts of how things played out as to why we actually, you know, that our own administration created 9/11 as an excuse to go to war so we could capture the mineral rights that we were in competition with China. Because China had the good sense to go in there and grab up those mineral rights before we did. So my perspective on Lisa Leaks is just providing evidence.
Yes, and
not just
like you just
perspective, just evidence.
Well, you have variety there, and you've got some great articles. I just want to remind people again, if you go to LisaLinks.com, it's the October 18th article, The Alabama Project, and that's what we've been talking about tonight. It's fascinating because everybody's heard about the Watergate and all of this, and this is why Nixon had to leave. But now you bring us this whole other story, and we know that George Wallace, well, just like you were saying, the shooter with no gloves on, no prints on the gun, so that there was something funny. But then you come to us and you just tell us pretty much what it was all about. So,
well, Ruthann, you're the first person that has invited us to talk about this. I mean, this is the first time that Warren and I have had the opportunity, you know, that someone has, you know, the chutzpah to allow us to share our story, you know, on the airwaves. And so that's so appreciated.
Well, I'm honored, and I'm sure not going to be the last one, because this is going to get out, and it's it does change history. Like you said, it's history changing. So I think it's wonderful what you've done. And don't wear yourselves out. I know you talk every day, and, you know, but take some time. I know when you get something going and you have such a passion, it becomes pretty much your life. But
I love it.
Well, do you know, right before you leave, do you know when you might hear something back from, like, the Nixon Library, the Kennedy Library? I would assume.
Well, we're hoping we're hear something back, you know, within the next couple of weeks. I talked to Greg Cummings. He is the director of the Nixon Library, and I spoke to him this week. His research team is on it, and said I'll get back to you, you know, within the next few days. And I mean, if they include Seymour's, you know, manuscript, we're golden, as far as I'm concerned. You know, that would be a real boost for us. And
definitely.
I just hope, I just a shout out there to anyone that, you know, that sees the worthiness of the story will reach out to us and want to help us get it published.
Yeah, for sure. And I thank you both for coming in and for talking about it, because this has to be bittersweet for Warren, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, but you're fulfilling something your father really wanted, and even though it's taken all this time, you're getting it done. So please come back and keep us informed as to, you know, how you're coming, and then when the publishing hits, well, then we want to know more.
Yeah, so, you bet.
Yeah. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Lisa Goodman from LisaLinks.com. So, good night. Have a wonderful weekend.
You have a great weekend too, Roseanne, and thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roseanne. Thank you very much.
All righty. Bye bye.
Take care.
Okay. Welcome to the second hour of Feed Your Head. We have with us tonight Tim King from SalemNews.com. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Ruthann. How are you tonight?
I am great. It's so good to have you here.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I've been enjoying your show right up till now. I've been a faithful listener, so here we go. And I thought that was a great hour you just had, by the way.
A great what?
Well, a great hour with your last guest. I mean, I was, you know, it's just such relevant information that slips by America with no one knowing anything. Isn't it just amazing how...
Really?
Yeah.
You never know when that little tidbit might lead to something, because just like that, Warren had posted it somewhere and just, you know, saying that he had evidence, but Lisa picked up on it and hunted him down.
Right.
So, that kind of thing. But now, in the news business, you're well aware of picking up on something and hunting it down.
Yeah, I think you could say that in all fairness, all kinds of things, and it's a real never-ending list. You know, we just try to keep people at the center of it, you know. All people are good in my book, and they all deserve the same, and it's a pretty simple premise to go by, pretty good guiding, you know, sense that... Anyway, you know, we started Salem, and, you know, there's a dash, salem-news.com. Otherwise, people go to Massachusetts, and they're nice people also. But
Right. I was going to say that, the salem-news.
Yeah. It's hard. But anyway, we started as a local news group and quickly learned that it's the international, you know, scene that really comes after what we have to offer the most. So that's how it's gravitated over 8 years, and... you know, some of the stories that we put out, to me, they're just beyond belief. And it's really just the great people that we become connected with. That's always it, right? I mean, it's how good are your connections?
Sure. It's people.
They're just people, right.
Right. And you're the news editor. Your wife, Bonnie, is the publisher, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
You've got over 100 staff writers in 22 countries.
Yeah, it's at least 20. It might be 25, but it's hard to keep up. You know, it's always...
Sure.
It goes up more than it goes down, but, you know, some people, you know, part ways with us, or they have some new direction in life that comes up, but maybe we've had 10 writers that have, you know, been part of our team, but then ceased to be that. But so mostly it just keeps growing, and, you know, we're in some really cool places that most people have never heard of, you know, like Balochistan. I mean, we really pay a lot of attention to what's going on there, and Burma, of course, right now, Myanmar, whatever people like to call it, and Sri Lanka and Palestine and Iran and Lebanon and...
Uganda, I saw, yeah.
That was Bonnie. Or was that Uganda? Or no, that was a Kenya article about people in their hospitals that are not being allowed to leave if they can't pay their bills, so they're kept as prisoners.
Okay. Well, no, I looked on the site for staff, and I did see Uganda, but I don't remember who was from there. But no,
we sailed through, yeah. Kiflu Hussein is our one writer who lives in Uganda, and so he pops up a lot. It's so educational to work with these people because they know so much that I'll never be able to know, you know, because of where they live. So it's really valuable.
Right there.
I know.
How did you start getting, let's give it a little background. Now, you've worked in the news before you started this.
It's all I know. Yep, I came out of the Marines and went into the news. Figure that one out. I started in 1988 as a news anchor at a small station in Oregon, and then I went into radio where I actually learned how to write. You know, I learned, you know, we gather what we do from college, but news is a very particular, as you know, it's a style of writing, and radio is extremely different from newspaper, which is extremely different from TV when it comes to, well, maybe not extremely, you know, but just depending on the number of mediums that you have to back up what you're saying. So, radio, and then we made a documentary for Oregon Public Broadcasting about the final flight of a World War II B-17 bomber that crashed in on the Oregon coast in 1943. And this one guy survived, and we found him half a century later, and we brought him back and introduced him to the guys that rescued him. So that was really cool.
Yeah.
Kind of propelled what we were doing. And then from there, we went to Yuma. We both went to work for the NBC station in Yuma, Arizona, one of the hottest places on earth, but really fun, right on the Mexican border, and lots of interesting stuff. Marine Corps base, where I had served, which is one of the reasons I took the job there.
Mm.
And that's a Harrier base, you know, the jump jets that fly straight up like a helicopter. Very cool. And then from there, we went to Las Vegas, went to work for the NBC. I stayed there for a year. Then I went to the Fox, and then we ended up doing our own TV show in Vegas called Hot Wheels in Las Vegas that was about cars in the Las Vegas Strip. It was pretty exciting.
Mm.
And then after Vegas, back to Oregon, freelance for a little bit, and then I was picked up by the ABC in Portland where I reported and shot video, and then from there we started Salem News.
Wow.
And I don't mean to rattle so much, but like one of the really fundamental pieces of this is that there are only 226 DMAs, or TV markets, in America. You probably know this, but I think maybe a lot of listeners don't. And so when you think of how many cities there are in America, and then you say 226 TV markets, well, that's not a good arrangement, and it isn't. And every market, of course, has the networks, if they're there. You know, ABC, NBC, CBS, and I think Fox is considered a network these days, whatever. But
I think so, yeah.
But so, like when you live in Salem, Oregon, an hour from Portland, the market, you get no news coverage. When you live in Laguna Beach, an hour on a good driving day from the LA TV market, you get no news coverage. I mean, it is just crazy. So that's what we started. And, you know, the Examiner and some other groups are doing this kind of today where they're, you know, making people have a voice in all these different communities. That's what we wanted to do. But instead, we became one big voice from one website, and there you go. And then I went and covered Afghanistan and Iraq, and that's what completely changed my politics in this world.
I was going to ask you about that, because you were pretty much embedded in those countries.
Yeah, 2 months in Afghanistan and 1 month in Iraq. And Afghanistan was fascinating because it was earlier in the war and people still had some hope. I kind of doubt they do today over there. And then Iraq was just sad, just sad. You know, it was 08. The surge was ending. I'll try to control my language when I talk about things like the surge, because I don't have a very high opinion of the policymakers of this country.
You can use it.
That's cool.
Well, was it hard for you to go there?
No, because I'm not smart enough to be scared, you know. I mean, other people that have better skill sets than me, they know danger and they know these things. And for me, it's just, I had been a Marine, and I had been a Marine during peacetime. And so that, it's just inevitable that every guy that was in the Marines wants to at least understand what war is. So I had to go understand it as a civilian. But, you know, there are so many good American people, and the soldiers and the Marines in the war are not the problem. Some of them are, but by and large, it's you know, and we just keep, we're thrown into these bullshit wars that have no basis and no reason for existing, and the violence in the world is unprecedented. You know what the biggest problem is the mindset that there are too many people in the world. This is a Republican thing that dates way back. George Harrison rallied against it around the time that he did the concert for Bangladesh, which I believe was 74. But there's a wonderful interview with him on YouTube where he just dispels the idea that there are too many people. We're just, obviously, you know, we need birth control, and we need food, and we need security.
It's not like we don't have things to support these people, but we need to be a little more equal in doling it out. Capitalism is not necessarily a good thing. It's not friends to the people.
Right.
And that's what we see, because while we may have, although even America's changing now, because one out of four kids goes to bed hungry, but in the past, like, we had way more stuff. And you can look at all the obese people and say the same thing now. And then you see the pictures of the kids that, you know, if they get one meal every other day, they're lucky, kind of thing. So, but it's not that we don't have food or the ability to raise it. We have land. We know how to farm.
People everything. Yep.
Know how to do these things.
And we need to quit destroying the earth. You know, I wrote a story recently called War and Tourism. And you think about the impact war has on tourism. And it's like a 10,000-year thing, you know, these lifespans of these radioactive bombs that we use.
Yeah, that's correct. You mentioned the Marines, and I wanted to say, I was just like, oh, well, that's strange and sort of cool. You've, on your staff, you've got tons of Marines.
Yes, and I'm their long-haired leader. Isn't it just the funniest thing you've ever heard in your life? It's so wonderful and great. The Marine Corps, you can take the guy out of the Marines, but you can't take the Marines out of the guy. I guess that's it. Ooh, that could be misconstrued, couldn't it?
That could be misconstrued, so, yeah.
But, yeah, 18 now, I believe, is the number. And the most recent guy, he and I worked together back in the early 80s at El Toro. El Toro Marine Corps Air Station, Southern California. It was the coolest Marine base in the whole world, and it was closed down to make it into houses and a park, and it's the most contaminated spot in Southern California. There's not a worse place. It's just, well, we call it toxic soup, and all my friends are dead, and I'm not joking. My friends and the handful of us from El Toro, we have a very hard time finding the guys we served with, and I'm not that old, you know? I mean, I'm in my 40s still, but...
Right.
They're all dead. They're gone from cancer. I have one friend that buried two children and had male breast cancer himself. Camp Lejeune, of course, the other Marine base, which is still active on the East Coast, is the one where they have to admit how contaminated it is. And my understanding was they hit number 79 male breast cancer patient the other day. And this is like, you know, 1,000 times above the norm.
Oh, my God. Yes, it is.
You should see the picture of these Marines that all had breast cancer with their shirts off, saluting the camera in black and white. They all have a breast removed. It will just make you buckle. It makes me buckle. I mean, it's so powerful.
Thing we do, and then, I know a couple of vets who actually are getting good treatment at a couple hospitals, and so they have things to say, but I think they're the exception.
Well, it's regional. It's a regional issue. Yeah.
More
rich people, more officers retire in some areas, and in those areas, the VA care is very good, like places in Arizona. But, you know, go to Portland, Oregon, or go to many other places, and you don't find the same thing, you know. But lest we forget, as much as we criticize the VA, that there are great people in the VA.
Oh, yes.
And they're tougher than all the rest of us because they're actually staying inside and fighting from within. I tried doing that in TV for a lot of years, and, you know, I found it not something I could do. I had to go out and start my own media organization, you know, because...
Yeah.
But, so, I admire those who stay within. And, again, we can't ever forget that there are good people in all branches of government. Even the most sinister ones have good people in them. And where does our information come from anyway, right? I mean, a lot of the time, from those good people.
From those good people, right,
mm-hmm.
because they are good and they can't stomach it without trying to do something to help. So.
Right, yeah, like the ATF guys that actually were the ones to bring out Fast and Furious. Not that we hadn't written about it before it came out, but, you know, they were fully retaliated against, you know, and that story. Yeah. But it's a better day in Mexico, you know, with PRI back in office, and I'm not a big fan of PRI, and I know that they've got a lot, you know, big history of corruption, but the people are already, the murders are already stopping. I don't know, you know, how much of a sense people have on this.
We had, like, what, something like 60,000 people were killed over the last 6 years?
Isn't that more than we lost in Iraq? Maybe Iraq and Afghanistan put together?
Probably.
And of course, we had so much to do with this.
It's just shameful.
That's like the Vietnam 58,000. You're talking about the casualties that we had in Vietnam
in
6 years.
58,000.
Mm. Hmm? 58,000, yep.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, those pictures, you know, again, Salem News, we might as well be in Mexico or Portugal or one of these places where there's no hesitation to put up a picture of a dead body. We don't hesitate. We try to warn people. But, you know, this is like,
I think it's so important. I think it is so important. And I have friends on Facebook who just really take offense. And it's like, well, I don't put it on their page, okay? It's on mine. So then they can block me or not look at it or whatever. I think it's so important that we see what, in many cases, our tax money is doing.
You better believe it, including the drones in Pakistan.
Oh, yes, yes.
But then, you know, each one of these is such a significant subject that we could spend years trying to figure it out and take it apart. And and yet they just keep popping up.
Right, right. I mean, what an exciting time, though. I mean, then we had something like last week with the UN citing Palestine. And, I mean, I know that it's, in a way, it's not a big deal. In another way, it's a huge deal.
It's a, yeah, and I know what you mean.
I just cried and cried and cried.
I know. Hey, when you're done, go look at my next to the top story tonight called Why Israel, Oh Why. And it's the new clip from Gaza. I'll tell you what, though, we put it out last week. We were told that it was from the new attack. And I can tell you that when I was watching this video, which is one of the hardest things I've ever watched in my life, that the Samuni children are in the end of it. And if you remember Ken O'Keefe's work on this, you know, that's the family.
Yeah.
So that tells me that I don't think the video that we're talking about is really from the new attack, or it has something from Castled tagged onto the end of it. And honesty is everything, and it doesn't matter what attack. It's the same. It's what it is, and
right.
We can't. So we can, but I just want to be clear on that, that we did put that out initially because it came from Senegal. And, I mean, this is video that no one's seen. With all these years, well, 3 years having passed, four years? Yeah. But none of us have seen this. And there's more children and more just heavy stuff than, anyway. But, so, yeah, and I snapped about 31 pictures out of that video, and I'm building them into the article, and it's just gut-wrenching. It's really bad. But, you know, the worst stuff that I ever publish is from Sri Lanka. And that is, there's a lot of movement on that right now. Real quickly for your listeners, the Tamil people, Tamil Nadu, India, is the coast of India across from Sri Lanka. And a large number of Tamil people live in Sri Lanka. And when the country gained independence from the British in 1948, the British had given some preferences to Tamil people. And the Sinhala Buddhists resented that. And so from 1948 till now, the game has been to eliminate the Tamil people. And first they tried to do it through legal legislation, and by 2006 they waged a full attack and murdered up to 160,000 people, mostly civilians. Yes, Tamil Tigers were part of it, and I won't even start on my advocacy of the Tigers, because they were an elite fighting force that protected the Tamil people for a long time. And, of course, they don't exist anymore. They were completely eliminated.
Right. Yeah.
But you know that I'm the only American to speak of that has written about this, and this is one of the biggest points in the world, if I could make one, and that's that we journalists in America must pay attention to these things, and the reporters will get this incredible personal benefit from it. They'll become the I don't know what word to use. It's not hero, but I just can't tell you how many thanks I get every single day from people from Sri Lanka and from Burma for paying attention, and Balochistan. Those are the three most obscure that we cover. Palestine, everyone's got an opinion. Everyone's got something to say. Thank goodness, because it's in the news more. But, you know, 90% of Americans are still in that mindset. And it's terrible, and it's tragic for the Jewish people of Israel, who are just fine. They're normal people.
Right.
They've got this radical political element in the Likud party that's just leading them right to the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, and, I mean, I feel for them just like I feel for us.
You
know?
We're watching Iraq happen and stuff.
Yeah, like we're in the same boat. Now, Balochistan, this is a part of Pakistan, am I right?
That's correct. Balochistan was annexed by Pakistan in 1948. It had always been its own sovereign nation. It was annexed, 48's the year that this world was put
into
that order.
Well, that was the year that Kashmir.
Kashmir, Palestine, Sri Lanka,
Rwanda,
and it goes on, I know. And we don't learn anything, you know, because the Rohingya Muslims who are being murdered right now, there's a doctor in Chicago who is a human rights doctor, and we've worked closely together on this, and she describes what's taking place there as a Bosnia-style genocide. You probably know that that's a very difficult, to say war crime, okay, that's not so difficult to prove. To say genocide, that's a lot harder. So it just means it's more severe. Even Sri Lanka, there's a big debate over whether that amounts to genocide. And that's stupid. Genocide, let's see, 10,000 or more people were murdered for a particular ethnic or religious reason. I call that genocide.
Yeah, that's genocide. Yeah, I think by the real definition, that's genocide.
Doesn't it seem, you know, and there's just, and the strife, the religious problems are all over the world. I don't know if you heard in Hungary last week. Now, I don't really know too much about this, but they wanted to list all the Jewish people that they thought were a potential threat. And, of course, this is ridiculous. I mean, just
no,
even say things like that. Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
And but then what did we do in the United States to the Arab people during the whole 9/11 fiasco, right? I mean, and that's...
Exactly. Total,
yeah.
Total. Like, profile.
Yeah. And then the internment camps of World War II, which are just another travesty of justice. And
right, with our Japanese citizens in them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Who went off to fight in World War II in the 442nd Nisei Regiment and were the highest decorated of all of the U.S. Army units in World War II. Those guys would sacrifice themselves without even a second thought while their parents were in internment camp. How do you... It just gives me chills to say it.
I know. It does. It's like they... I don't know, better people than I am. I don't think I would have been able to do that. Just like the Native Americans did a lot in the war. And look at the way they were treated.
Yeah, the inspiration of Hitler.
Yeah. Well, and then we had different groups of, I think it was in the Second World War, too. The blacks couldn't be with the whites, or was that in the First World War?
No, that was in World War II, and the U.S. military was desegregated in 1947. So hence you have the Tuskegee Airmen, the black pilots. And then the one that we've written so much about, who are the black Marines from World War II who stormed the beach at Iwo Jima. Our writer, Coral Thiel, is the first person to ever bring this out. These are the Montford Point Marines from World War II, and they were heroic, and they were black, and they were fantastic, and they're under-recognized. And she has written their story extensively, and she found footage of them actually hitting the beach at Iwo Jima from another former Marine. And we put that up, and that's Clint Eastwood's movie. Remember that he did the movie, is it called Flags of Our Fathers or the other one, but he didn't put any black Marines in it. He said no, and it's so messed up because they were there, and there was no easy storming of the beach at Iwo Jima. There was no, you know, maybe they went in after some of the other guys, but so, I'm sorry, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but it's so loaded with discrimination. In World War One. There was a pilot, one black pilot in the whole war. And this is, you know, the Red Baron time and all of that. And his name was Eugene Bullard. And Eugene Bullard actually, he only was allowed to fly for the French. When the U.S. entered the war, he was made a trench soldier again. The United States, when it entered World War One, forced France to adopt racist military policies that it had never had. And that's why people, when they go to Paris today, and they talk about, now I've been treated great in Paris, I don't have any problems, but other Americans talk about, you know, and the reason is this, World War One. I don't think the average Parisian knows why they dislike Americans today, but that's why their great-grandfathers or grandfathers hated Americans, is because we forced their military to segregate, and then all the veterans from the 20s, throughout the 1920s, were taking their wives over to France to show them where they fought, and they wouldn't allow blacks to work in the restaurants, they had to be like America. We've really contaminated the world a lot in our short little lifespan as a country, and it makes me sick. And people never talk about the bad stuff. You know, the media doesn't talk about it. They don't talk, when they talk about Iran and they talk about the hostages, they never mention that the Iranians let the blacks and the female Americans go. They said, you have enough problems back in your country, and they didn't hold them. And that's such a humiliating embarrassment that Americans won't admit it, but they should.
That's it. A lot of people don't know. And there's a lot of things. I mean, it's just in the past few years that I've come to understand the truth about my country. And it's just so disheartening.
Mm-hmm. And knowledge is like a poison and a curse, you know, depending on how you... And how much can you do with it? I feel like I get to do more. You have your show. I have my site. So we get to actually battle it. You know, we're actually... firing bullets, but man, for the people that don't, you know, and I understand the frustration of the people that leave comments on stories, you know, of course, we're the land of shills. I wonder how many dollars are exchanged every year for people to just go around and put their politics on website comments. You wouldn't believe the stuff.
Quite a bit. And, I mean, we hear about the Israeli Internet Defense Force, whatever, but I think we've got our own here.
Yeah. Do you know the term Hasbara? Are you familiar?
That sounds familiar, and I should know, and I can't give you...
You've probably read it, but Hasbara is the training, the conditioning of pro-Israeli people, mainly in Israel. But it's like kind of the rule book, the handbook, the things that you say. You know, when somebody criticizes Israel for war crimes, you call them an anti-Semite. It's all of that stuff, you know.
Right, and bring up the Holocaust.
immediately bring up the Holocaust. And not that it shouldn't be brought up, but like as I wrote in my article on the last couple of days, most people in Israel, if you were a Shoah or Holocaust survivor, if you didn't move to Israel by 53, you get nothing. You get more money every month from the German government than you get for your own. And so consequently, you have thousands of Holocaust survivors in Israel living in abject poverty. And it's embarrassingly terrible, tragic, shameful. What is wrong with people? I mean, they should be the most valued citizens on the face of the earth. But you know what? A lot of them stand up for Palestine. So,
well, they do.
Yeah, right, because they know. They understand.
Yeah. I mean, and so I have no problem with the real Jewish religion.
Right.
Because we know Zionism isn't a religion.
It's a
political entity.
It's a 110-year-old problem, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. It's a plague.
Right.
But it sure isn't a religion.
Yep.
So, because people try that, though. Well, you're anti-Semite. It's like, no, I'm not. You don't get it.
You don't get. Well, they get it, but they're not going to admit that they get it. Right.
Yeah.
It's the tool in the box. And you know what? Let's just take a moment and say every religion sucks. There's nothing. I mean, I believe in all that is good is great, right? If people are walking the walk of a Christian or a Buddhist or a real Muslim or a real Jew.
No, I agree. I agree with you.
Yep.
The religion itself is probably okay, but it's the way it's been interpreted and the way the people who claim to follow it behave.
That's right.
You want to throw up.
And to believe that these books are not, I mean, the Bible is so completely edited, and then, the Quran is edited. I don't know about the Torah. I mean, they're all scary books, though. Every one of them has supremacy. This is the only religion. Every one of them has people murdering. You know, the Bible, you got girls getting their father drunk so they can have sex with them. I mean, you got Moses running around killing everybody in every village during the wandering years. It's like, what on?
Right.
Was God a student?
You know, but it's... Yeah, and you can find anything you want in the Bible anyway, you know, because it's so contradictory.
I know.
You can. So there's some beautiful stories, and there are stories. That's
right.
And there's Psalms and Proverbs. Some of those are beautiful. The Proverbs, actually, they have quite a few good things there. You know, there's a lot if you want to pick and choose and just say literature-wise, but to...
Mm-hmm.
Base your life on something in the Old Testament, please.
Oh, please. Or any of them, really. I admit I'm a fan of Jesus. I think Jesus was completely cool. Of course, he would be arrested for terrorism in about 5 minutes today.
Well, you know that, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, let me throw another one out, though. There's a producer in Iran named Reza, and I should be able to say his last name. He's kind of famous over there, but no one over here has heard of him. But he made a movie that's on YouTube. Anyone can watch it. Called Black Box 9/11, and this is it's an incredible movie. It's super well made, and the long shot of it is that at the end of the movie, the point they make is that, you know, we the Christians, whatever the Americans, believe that we are dealing with the return of the Messiah, right? And the Muslims believe that they're dealing with the return of the Mufti, their version of the Messiah.
Man.
So what they're saying in Iran is that they're going to come back together. That's really cool. I like that notion. But here's what they really believe. They really believe that the U.S. has been waging wars over there since 1990 so that the U.S. can have a nice, secure piece of ground where they... I know this is really out there, okay? But Jesus... If you read this stuff and if you take the interpretations, there are two places where he's likely to come back. One is Sumatra and one is Karbala. In other words, Iraq. And so that means, according to this theory, which I'm not saying it's my theory, but it's really a good theory, that's why the U.S. has been over there pounding the ground and building these huge fortresses that you know that we are still controlling them. We have Blackwater people in there instead of, you know, uniformed American troops. But, yeah, how's that? I mean, let yourself think about that. Think of the right-wing religious crazies in Washington having a meeting one day, and, we got to, it's like they want to prepare a place for Jesus so they can what? Draft him, you know what I mean?
Oh,
throw him right into the lineup? Anyway.
Okay, well, that's a theory. That's all,
It's a theory, but it's a good movie, Black Box 9/11.
I just wrote that down. Okay, you say it on YouTube, yeah. Well, I just wanted to say your paper has a couple things in it that I'm not used to seeing. Along the left side, you have business news, sports, weather. Those things are not confined to, but a lot of it has to do with Oregon, the sports, your weather. But
yeah.
You've got cannabis news.
Yes.
I love it. It's like, what? I've never...
Man, how long do we have? No. Yeah, cannabis news. From the beginning, we've just treated cannabis, marijuana, to be the thing it is. You can imagine, I grew up in L.A., so I was around it. I've been around it all of my life. And so to me, it's not even, there's no question. But we're talking about medical treatments, and we're talking about, you know, Dr. Philip Levesque is our mentor. He's my personal mentor. He is a Salem News writer for many years. He's 89. He's recovering from a broken hip right now. But he is absolutely an amazing man. He fought in World War II. His wife was a Holocaust survivor. He trained the first doctors in Uganda and Tanzania ever. And then he adopted a boy who was the son of a family who Idi Amin's people were out to kill. He adopted him and brought him back and raised him in America. And today that gentleman is a very successful businessman in Los Angeles. So Doc Levesque and his wife, what a hoot they would have been around to know together. I've never met his wife, but I've seen her artwork, which is Holocaust inspired, and her father was the last practicing Jewish doctor in Germany, because the Germans, he was so good that they kept him right till the end of the war, and then they killed him, and then so she ended up an orphan, and what a tragic story. But so Doc Levesque helped Oregon get its medical marijuana law, and he's friends with every key person in the movement that there is. And so when Jack Hare died, and they're very old friends, Bonnie and I were there when Jack had his heart attack at the big festival in Oregon. And we monitored and kept up on that. And then Bonnie actually wrote the chapter on Jack's death for the latest edition of Jack's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. So I shouldn't even be the one talking about this. Bonnie is the one who has been so dedicated, and she has a way of doing it where, you know, there's obvious bias. We believe what we believe, and you can't hide that. But
yeah.
She's really good when she writes about this. And she's, you know, we've done a few, probably 1,000 articles since 2004, and many videos with Doc. We will get back into the swing on that again. But, you know, he's got to get through his hip and
right. Things
like that. But, yeah, it's a fantastic subject. I mean, do you get into it sometimes on your show?
Not yet, but I hope to. We've just touched it in a couple different shows that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would like.
Right. Well, you've got so many things you can talk about with regard. You've got the history of it, right? In fact, I was visiting with another author last night who has a lot of information on these sub roads that come out of the whole 1937 Cannabis Tax Act and, you know, these things. But there's just so much to talk about. And right now in California, you wouldn't believe what it's like to be a medical marijuana patient and to go into a dispensary. And the way that they've got these places laid out is so stellar and great, and they're the nicest people. I think California's headed for a better day, but, you know, I hope so. I mean, in that respect, you know, it doesn't hurt people. I mean, it might make some people lazy. I don't know, whatever. But, then look.
Well, Washington, really, the other day, they decriminalized it, I believe.
The whole state decriminalized it, and it went into effect last night at midnight.
Right.
And now the cops say, or now the feds say they're going to sue both Washington and Colorado for passing these laws, which
now,
is just...
I thought that they said that they wouldn't if the states passed whatever... They might have said it, but that doesn't mean they'll do it.
Right, and it's all secondhand. I'm only repeating to you what Doc Levesque told me today. I haven't looked into that and seen it myself, so I probably should before I get into it too much.
That's just so ridiculous, because it is going to happen. Just like the same thing in Washington, they started marrying gay couples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I mean, it's happening.
Right.
They may as well just, you know...
We want things to happen the right way. You know, I did stories with the first lesbian couple in Oregon that got that whole, you know, marriage thing going too. And we have friends that have been impacted by that. I just can't believe we're so worried about the things we're worried about as a society. And we're not. It's the media that programs people to be worried about it.
Well, it is, because, you know, just like during the whole election process and all, they would find all these ridiculous things to spread all over, instead of asking the candidates real questions, you know, that might give you a clue as to what they might do. So we just had to surmise.
Right.
But it's always to take the heat off of what's really going on.
That's right. That's right. I wrote in the beginning of this whole thing, I said, you know, we're going to spend billions and billions and billions of dollars are going to be spent. It's bullshit. Romney is completely unelectable. So every bit of this money will be spent, and it's going to fund the media, but it's not going to help anyone.
Right.
And what happens, but, you know, Obama wins. But you know, you got to take into account, too, that he's not an honest guy. I mean, and Hillary Clinton just makes me, I want to run for the toilet. I mean, it's so... And I used to think so much of her, you know?
I did, too. I mean, I was a Bill and Hill fan, I have to admit.
Yeah.
Those days are gone.
No, they're corporate politicians, and they work for the corporate world, and we need to get rid of them and move them out if we have any hope. You know, the only answer towards salvation is in democracy, and it's in voting, and it's in... But whether we can ever pull the ball back into our hands, I doubt. You know, one of the biggest stories in my lap right now is the story about the Ganjgal ambush. And I don't know how much you know, but in Afghanistan in 2009, there was an ambush of these Marines and soldiers, and many were killed. And they were put into an impossible situation that was completely set up for them to die in. And this is, you know, Dakota Meyer is the Marine that won the Medal of Honor. Pretty recently, he's got a book out, and he's the one guy that lived. But I'll tell you what, like names to remember for that you'll be hearing a lot more about in the future. Mark Kimmett, he was the U.S. Army general during the Iraq War. He was on TV defending Abu Ghraib. He was on TV defending Fallujah. He's the one that this one particular Marine worked for back in the 2003 and 4 years. And the whole Ganjgal ambush happened to take out that one Marine. Because like these Navy SEALs who keep dying, he was a special ops guy who knew too much. He was a high security clearance guy, and they had him killed because he knew too... it's so horrific.
That was like the 24 or however many SEALs that killed, supposedly, Osama bin Laden.
That's complete another crap also. I know, you're way ahead. I'm so glad, too. I hate getting into discussions with people who are not, but Obama. Osama bin Laden was a heroic guy that helped defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan. He got really pissed off that the U.S. went over to Saudi Arabia to defeat the Iraqis. He's like, come on, I'm sitting here with the Mujahideen. We just kicked the Soviets' ass. Let me go deal with Saddam Hussein, because there's no love between these countries. But people don't, they're not taught anything. They're not taught, what is a Wahhabi? What is a Salafi? What is, you know, what is a dangerous Muslim faith versus a non-dangerous, you know? And of course, the bad guys are our allies.
That's the thing. The real terrorists, us and our allies, are supposedly the ones who are out to save everybody from terrorists who are freedom fighters. It's all perspective, but it's the whole Osama bin Laden thing. I fight with people who in many ways are quite bright, but they just refuse. Well, the government wouldn't really lie about that. Head out of your ass and let's talk about this. But
Oh, the way he kept popping up for Bush whenever, you know.
Yeah.
And his final stage appearance was for Obama so he could get elected. I mean, no one would not elect Obama after he killed bin Laden, you know.
Right. That was for totally his political. Yeah. Obama got Osama. Oh, my God. It was amazing. And the people just fed into that. And they were, we got him. We got him. Oh, my goodness.
I know. Did you see the neighbor, the Al Jazeera interview with the neighbor of that house in Pakistan? It's so funny. He says, I've been walking. He says, I own the house next to this one in Abbottabad that he was supposedly in. He says, I've been walking by this house every night for 5 years. He says, and I'll tell you what, if you live in a community like this, you know when somebody new is in town. He goes on. He completely refutes. He goes, I don't think he was in there. He goes, in fact, I know he wasn't in there. And the Al Jazeera guy's like, oh, okay, well, thank you. He's trying to end the interview, and the guy just keeps going. It's really good.
That was just such a fake thing. And of course, then, you know, well, they dumped the body at sea.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Somebody said, well,
I got some beachfront land in Florida. You want to buy it?
Yeah, right. What about, oh, there's a bridge and there's a, yeah, all these things.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That too, yeah.
But
no, it's terrible.
Somebody told me, well, no, that was him. And I said, well, so the body? They said, well, they took some pictures and they showed it to about a dozen congressmen. It was really, what are you, you know?
Yeah, what are you smoking? Send some to me. Right.
But no, because once you see the lies and all, then you get better at picking out more. But we started on this because of the SEALs, because you were talking about him. He was part, just like these men, who the SEALs that took him out, and then they're in this helicopter. What was it? A week or two later, and they die.
Yep, because they're all, we're going to talk. It's so bad. It's so blatant. It's so in your face. I can't believe this stuff. I can't believe it.
That's a good way to shut people up. If you don't think they're going to talk, if you think they're going to talk, kill them away.
Man, this guy, this Marine that was killed at Gonsgal, when he worked for Mark Kimmett, an Army general, he was a Marine sergeant. I'm sure you know enough about the military ranks to know that that's vastly different, right? A sergeant is like, yes, sir, no, sir. That's the only thing he says to a general. Two times in a room with many other officers present, the Marine, Aaron Kenefick, completely laid into that general and called him names and debased him in front of several other people.
Wow.
Now, that tells you that he knew things on that guy, and there was nothing the guy could really do except ultimately send him into this place and get him killed. But the story, by the way, for your listeners, if they go to salem-news.com, just scroll down to the bottom and you'll see the story. Aaron Kenefick, a Marine who knew too much. And I've got the next one coming up is 5 smoking guns from the Gonsgal ambush. And I'm going to illustrate some points that are just going to really blow people away. You know, they had drones that morning that were flying up in the air watching all of these jihadis carrying rocket launchers moving into this village, and they never shared it with the guys that were on their way there. It's because they were sent there to be killed. There were, when they called for artillery, the army wouldn't fire any artillery. And when there were 2 helicopters in the immediate area when they came under this full-thronged attack, they called for the helicopters got called off. And it's just one thing. After all the guns were jamming.
You know what, that you're just talking about the USS Liberty.
Oh, the Liberty, one of the most sad subjects.
It's the same, when help was going to them, Johnson called it off.
That's right. No, they wanted it to sink,
Yes, they did, so that they could aid Israel against Egypt, because it was supposed to look like Egypt did it.
That's right, and so then the nuclear bomb nearly went to Cairo.
Yeah.
Yep. I know, and I love Phil Turney and all these wonderful guys that are with us that were on that ship that day. And they're such wonderful people. And I don't know if you've had any of them on your show, but you should.
I haven't, but he is actually on my list.
I'll bet.
Yeah, because, well, they are still trying to get Congress to, quote unquote, look into things.
Yep.
I mean, they try, and their numbers, that was a long time ago, and some of them are dying off, and every year they meet, and that just is very touching for me.
It is.
It really gets me. They just want what's due them.
And they just want some truth to be out on the table, right? And I'm sure that your listeners know about it, but this is the 1967 Six-Day War. Israel was, fighting all of its neighbors, and the U.S. was monitoring off the coast of Gaza with this ship, the USS Liberty. It was a spy ship. And they saw a couple of jets fly by, and they thought, oh, good, they're Israelis. And then
they waved to them.
I know, it's so bad. And there was at least one Marine that was killed on that ship, too, which, to me, it's all the same, sailor Marine, but it just gets personal,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But they're an incredible group, and every word they have to say is worth listening to. I certainly agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's amazing, but that's what you're talking about. They our own government sends people in to be killed so that they can say, well, look what the Afghanis did.
Look what the Egyptians did. That's right.
Did, kind of thing.
It's a long, dark road.
false flags, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, that's certainly the terminology, isn't it? And it's over and over again. It's to me, it's going on right now with Syria. I don't believe a word.
I don't either. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am so tired of fighting people over that.
Yep. Like, why would they know? Who was watching the facility to know that government vehicles were moving around? It's like, well, who the hell are you? What are you? Who are you? You know, what I mean, to the media group or whoever's putting that out. Well, it is their facility. It belongs to that government.
Well, somebody from the Pentagon supposedly said, I think it was Tuesday, that according to everything he'd heard, the Syrian the government was not mixing chemicals or doing anything like that.
Right.
But, you know, to hear other people, oh, my goodness. And you know,
I know.
Like,
you may not know this, but I came very, very close about 2.5 months ago to heading over to Damascus. I had a tentative invite from Assad to come over and interview him, along with the group. There were going to be 10 of us.
I jumped on that.
Well, it fell through. And this was after Homs. It was when the UN was still there. You know, like some insight on that, the UN guys were having to take out their credit cards to put gasoline into their military vehicles to do patrols. And they only had a couple hundred guys. Mm. And yet desperate people everywhere they went that wanted them to do all these things that they couldn't
do.
Sure.
Yeah, it would have been a scary situation.
Yeah, and that's who we were going to stay with, was the UN guys. And then they got pulled out, and it's like, well,
yeah,
no, they didn't want to bring us over and just get us killed. And that's fine.
Right.
I mean,
yeah. To interview Assad? Wow, that would be.
I know. I would have been really,
That would have been. But no, you're right. I mean, that's it's too scary now. And these crazy rebels that we're arming.
Oh, man.
There
are a lot of the guys that were fighting us in Iraq, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And not that I wouldn't, if I lived there, probably be one of them. I'm sure I would, but that's beside the point, you know. I mean, the Benghazi rebels, the first thing they did after getting Gaddafi, out and murdering him was go and destroy the British World War II cemetery at Benghazi. They kicked down all the crosses that were the gravestones, and they pulled down the big Christian cross. And it's funny, Gaddafi didn't allow that to happen, you know, but have him... Yeah, 1 week later. So.
Yeah, I get chills when I think of the way this country did Libya and Gaddafi.
Yeah.
The colonel
did
that.
Terrible.
No, it was horrible. And do you know in this last, what do they call it, pillar of whatever in Gaza, that I was told that...
Oh, pillage or pillar operation, yeah, whatever they call
operation
it.
Operation pillar.
Yeah.
This time, that cemetery that had been there for so long, that even had Jewish people in it, it was a beautiful cemetery. Victoria did a talk at the cemetery, and he pointed things out.
Oh, I've never seen this, really. I'll have to look for that.
Well, you got to see that. It was beautiful, but I heard that Israel took it out this time.
Oh.
It was like one of the few... last green places in town, and it was beautiful. It's an old cemetery and had the Muslims, but it had the Jewish people. You could see the Star of David on different stones around, and he sort of walked us through that. Golly, Tim, we've got to find that for you. It was just, you know, he's the
yes.
Negro, and he also wrote for you.
Vittorio wrote for us. We didn't have him on our staff page because he felt that it would just make it too dangerous for him. You know, when you look at, you see a lot of articles from us that are by Israeli writers like Nev Gordon, but none of them feel good about being on our page. And I understand, it doesn't make me, I mean, it hurts my feelings on behalf of the bigger picture. It's not personal, but so, you know, and there are so many inside of Israel who are trying. And these girls like Omer Goldman, the defector, who's the daughter of the second guy for Mossad, you know. I mean, I love them. I just think they're amazing.
Yeah.
And they're such an unheard voice.
The general's daughter or something. What did they call her? But yeah.
Yeah, I know. I should pull it up and look at it. But
it's amazing. And it's so inspiring.
It's so inspiring. And it's good, you know, the sexist male in me comes out and says it's good that we can take some beautiful young people and show them, you know, because they don't understand who's who, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And because look at Israel's representatives politically, they're always these white people. And it's like, you know, that's so unfair because the average Israeli looks pretty much like the average, you know, Palestinian. I mean, they don't look all that different, you know. They're all cousins in the beginning.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I have just such a problem with all the fundamentalist religions. Every single one of them, no exceptions, they're all terrible. And I'm glad Iran has laws to protect Jewish people, but that's one of the only countries over there that I know of that does, you know, and these allies of America, Saudi Arabia. Yeah, let's go be Jewish in Saudi Arabia. That would last, what, three minutes or something, you know? I mean, so.
That's what I heard, that the Jewish people in Iran, they like it just fine. They have no desire to go to Israel to live.
Oh, hell no. Go and be embroiled in all of that. I know.
No. They're fine. That's another, you know, it's funny how some of these dictators, leaders, whatever, you know, the West is always determined to bring democracy with their bombs. And yet most of the people are fine with them. Or, like, I have a couple of friends in Syria who say, you know, Assad's not the greatest, but it's like he's ours. We can take care of it.
Right.
Stay out. And
I know.
You know, that's, I just don't know where this imperialistic country that we live in, I don't know how it came about, but what, we've got 700 bases in, I don't know, over 100 countries around the world.
Well, we do. You know, in Africa, we were in, last year or the year before, I did a report on the U.S. AFRICOM. That's what they call the war theater, AFRICOM. And
right.
What I learned was that at that point, the U.S. had its claws in 56 of 57 African countries, and Libya was the only one that we didn't. So taking out Gaddafi was an economic corporate move.
Right. Well, he was trying to change to, I believe, back to the gold standard or something.
Yes, he was. That's right.
Right.
That's right.
And he had given money to different African countries to try to help them. And
yep.
he was doing as much as he could. And no, this country couldn't allow that.
Right. They had great infrastructure in their government. People were not starving. People were getting educations.
Yeah.
Again, there was no crazy religious element to it, not as much.
Yeah, but their literacy rate was great under him. I mean,
he really
brought it up. So.
Oh, man. And look at Iraq, too. You know, women were in government in Iraq. I mean, the radical religious thing was not part of Saddam Hussein's M.O., and yet we got to go kill him and take him out. And man, got to just leave things alone in this world and let people figure out their own problems and then respond when innocents are being pummeled. But since we're the ones that pummel them, there's no response.
No. But, you know, the word humanitarian, to me now, it gives me like this sort of a bitter taste in my mouth, because every time this country supposedly does something for humanitarian reasons, it's nothing to do with humanitarian reasons. If it was, we'd be feeding people in Somalia instead of droning them.
Yep.
Many instances of that. So it has nothing to do. It's only if there is some type of natural resource that we or the multinational corporations that fund our government can get something from. Otherwise, doesn't matter. They don't care.
You know what? I mean, this sounds really bad, but I look forward to the world not being punished by this country anymore. However it has to happen, you know, I'm a world citizen. I'm like Ken O'Keefe. You know, I'm a world citizen. I believe in all of us being the same. I believe in international law. Some American law, but there's so much bullshit tied in. The whole cannabis thing. And then you've got, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, you know, running the networks with their advertising, and we've just lost it. We've got, like you said, our heads stuck so far up our butts that there's...
Well, look at the GMOs. All these wonderful countries, Kenya just said no way. I mean, all of these countries, and I mean, we're talking third world countries, are saying no way. Europe dumped the GMOs, or they have some very strict regulations on a few things.
France still has a big problem with them, but yeah.
But,
right. We did a story on Belgian people putting up these huge – well, they were destroying Monsanto's farm fields. They were just flat out destroying them. I love them. They're great activists over there. Hands-on activists, not afraid to work it up a little bit and fight with the police and do it all. I love them. They're awesome.
But yeah, I mean, anybody that's fighting Monsanto, well, you know, India should be fighting them. Think about those hundreds of thousands of farmers that killed themselves because...
I knew you were going to say that, the suicides in India.
Yeah.
How many Americans know about this, though?
Not that many.
Yeah. Terrible, tragic suicides because of this contamination of our farm fields and their farm fields. But India is a place where you walk out of the historic, you know, Hindu temple and you're staring at nuclear reactors. I mean, it's such a...
Yeah.
Oh, I love it, though. And I haven't even been there, but I have so many friends there. And, you know, Bonnie and I were flown to Baltimore last July to speak about our work on the Sri Lankan war crimes. It was really a cool honor. I spoke in front of 3,000 Tamil Americans. And they, you know, they just, I don't know, I love India. I just love everything about it. And I want to go there and be part of it. There's a great movie called Rang Di Basanti. And everyone needs to watch this. It's an incredible movie that is really about the revolutionaries of the 1920s. But it's a modern interpretation of that. Rang Di Basanti, absolutely outstanding. And remember, Inqilab Zindabad, that means let the revolution continue. Because we can never stop. You know, the resistance, it has to be key, you know. And we have to scare the shit out of them. And we have to make them amend these terrible rules that are plaguing our society and so many people suffering. Oh, you need to watch that video on Gaza that I've got up on Salem-News. You're not going to believe it. You're not going to believe how up close it is to the tragedy. And the way the Gaza people work together to pull people out of these buildings. And oh, the tears are just, it's too much. You'll drown in tragedy, but it's worth watching.
Yeah. Well, you have Yosef Alhelo also as a writer for you.
Yes, although I don't get his content out enough. He's Press TV and Salem News. He does, you know, when Gaza's not under attack, he does amazing stories. Like one that I always think about is the antique car collectors of Gaza and how they can't get any parts because Gaza has no mail. I don't know if people know. You can't write a letter to Gaza.
No.
So, but yeah, so he catches the offbeat stuff and he's just a really, really wonderful guy, you know, and he spends time with Ken when Ken's over there and Joe Catrone, who's also not on our team. He's not listed, but, you know, one of the people we love to carry a lot. And so it's just, you know, it's wonderful.
You've built a wonderful group of people. And I mean, I think it's amazing. Because
I appreciate that. I think they're amazing, too.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people. And I know them all very well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you go down the staff page, you'll see me with, like, Bill Cook and Eileen Fleming and Ken O'Keefe and just all different people that we've actually had the time to hang out with.
I've had Eileen on the show. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Sure. Yeah. No.
Well, Eileen is extremely unique.
Oh, she's wonderful. And you've got Anna Leary.
Yes, isn't she the most wonderful activist from Ireland?
Oh, she is. The Irish people, I saw a short clip today, and I cried some more. There's a delegation in Gaza, and they took some type of a scooter thing. It makes you think sort of a small golf cart.
Right.
This one man who has had his leg shot off.
And right.
It was just so touching. But the Irish, in fact, I've got an interview coming up, I believe, next week with Robbie Martin from Dublin. And the Irish are just, they're gung-ho because they know what it's like to be occupied.
Damn right.
Man, they've been doing so much for Gaza, particularly, for Palestine. But it's amazing. So people are waking up.
They are.
That's just a good feeling. I mean, we can have something to do with that. It's like, wow, how cool.
And we're all on one page with Facebook and the internet and everything, and we're all just able to share information so quickly. I do think that we're, you know, in a way the world's on amend, but it's just, you know, and we have to remember how quickly all this bad stuff unfolded, and good can unfold quickly also. So
that's true. That's true. I'm so optimistic. We've just got a minute left, so tell us some words of wisdom, Tim.
All men are created equal. War is bad with no exceptions. There rarely is a time that it can be justified. Sanctions that make children starve and prevent people from having business relations, very bad. Fundamentalist religion, very dangerous. No such thing as a good religious government that I know of. You know, And so people just need to have balls. They just need to have courage, and they need to be willing to speak up and step out. And drop in, what was the Timothy O'Leary thing? It was drop out and, oh, dang it, I came up with a great phrase today, where you just reverse it, but anyway.
Right. And I can't do it either. But
drop, tune in and drop out, and I'm saying drop in and tune and drop out, drop in and tune out. Okay, never mind. Drop in like surfing on a wave.
Yeah,
I'll think of it
go.
Later.
Tune
so
out
great to talk with you on your show
media.
Tonight.
Okay, tune out the lamestream media. Go to salem-news.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tim. Really enjoyed this. This is nice.
Thank you. Okay, well, we'll talk again soon.
Yes, we will.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.